The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Watch this.
Brandon Tatum is a 7-year veteran of the Tucson Police Department. He's a YouTube sensation with 1.9 million subscribers. He started Blexit with Candace Owens, and now he's tackling his biggest assignment yet. This is the Officer Tatum Show.
Welcome to the Officer Tatum Show. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Brandon Tatum. Follow me on social media at The Officer Tatum on everything. Twitter, YouTube, Instagram. And Instagram, I'll be going off on Instagram on these little live streams that I do. So if you're interested, check me out. I was hoping to discontinue talking about Uvalde. I was really hoping that I was going to get the opportunity. I was hoping that I was going to have to lay off of it just because I wanted to, not because another shooting has taken the attention from Uvalde, where a gunman, 18-year-old man with a AR-15, and no, it's not an assault rifle, it's an Armalite rifle, went into a elementary school and began shooting indiscriminately. Now we have reports of a new shooting in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Came out yesterday. We didn't have a lot of the information, but if I was a betting man, I'm going to bet you guys that we're not going to hear much about this shooting for much longer. Why is that, Mr. Tatum? Because the shooter, according to the Associated Press, according to Daily Wire, the shooter was a black man. And y'all all know black man can do no wrong. And if somehow the police would have shot this man, even after he'd been in the active shooting, they would have cried racism in Tulsa. Now, I'm being, you know, a little bit exaggerated on the point, but you just mark my word. Let's see how long this shooting lasts. The black man, and I like to say that because when the police shoot somebody, they like to say a white cop. So this black man, according to the Tulsa Police Department, went into a hospital, St. Francis Hospital campus, and shot multiple people, killing four, and then ultimately turning the gun on himself and killing himself. This gentleman was between the age of 35 and 40, and apparently he had an issue. Now, I don't know how detailed these facts are, but according to the police, according to documents that I've read, he had an issue with the doctor in the hospital who performed a back surgery on him. I'm assuming he didn't like the surgery. Maybe he was dealing with excruciating pain. I hope I'm saying that word right. And he had enough. Now, he has to be absolutely crazy to go and shoot up multiple people because a doctor hurt his back during surgery. His back couldn't have been hurt that bad because he was able to show up at the scene with a rifle and a handgun and shoot multiple people. So the true motive of this shooter is very bizarre, and I don't think we actually know the true motive or the depth of the motive of this particular shooter. A couple of interesting points of reference, and a lot of people are going to try to compare this shooting to the shooting in Uvalde, and I'm going to be the voice of reason and say there is absolutely no comparison between these two shootings. Let me tell you why. Let me give you the first fact about this particular shooting in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at the hospital. Police response time to the call was 3 minutes after it was dispatched, and an additional 5 minutes after the call was dispatched, after they arrived on the scene. 5 minutes later, they found the suspect on the second floor of the hospital where he was deceased. Now, many people say it only took them about 9 minutes from the time the call came out to the time that they was able to contact the suspect. I think it was about 9 minutes, and that was very impressive, right? That's what people will say. In Uvalde, it took them Now, people don't know this because many people spend a lot of time saying that they were just sitting in the hallway twiddling their thumbs, playing on their phones for 40 minutes while kids were getting slaughtered. However, according to the documents, it took them 4 minutes from the time of the shooting for them to arrive and pursue him into the classroom where he barricaded himself. Now, if you look at the times, it took Tulsa police 9 minutes, and it took the police in Uvalde about 4 minutes to respond after the shooting had started. Now, the reason there's no comparison is because Uvalde is a city of 16,000 people, and they probably roughly only had about 7 officers at a time on duty per shift. And that's not a lot of police officers. You compare it to Tulsa, Oklahoma police officers, they're managing 400,000 people, and they have over 700 plus officers who are on their police department. So you're talking about a department. If you look at the Uvalde Unified School District, they have 6 police officers. And you go look at the Tulsa Police Department, they have 700 police officers. In a situation like this, I'm sure Tulsa has a SWAT team. I'm sure Tulsa it could have been 40 police officers showed up to this one call, ready to go. And what people may not understand, they may not know this, and this may not be applicable in this case, but I know when I was a police officer in Tucson, every hospital had their own security. They had their own K-9 security at the Tucson Medical Center. And at St. Joe's, they had a small security detail there. So they have direct communication with a person who they consider to be a security individual that's armed. I don't know if they're armed in any of these other hospitals. I don't know if they were armed at the particular hospital in Tulsa, but that could be a contributing factor to communication with police and a response time. However, it doesn't appear, based on the information that I've gotten, that he was confronted by anyone. It appears that he did the shooting that he was going to do in the place that he wanted to do and then killed himself. This adds to the shooting number that the Democrats tout around when they are speaking of taking away our guns. Now, in this case, you have a complete bizarre situation for the Democrats. And before I go on, you know, and say anything else, I feel like it's respectful for me to at least give some condolences for the people that lost their lives. I know I get caught up in being the spokesperson for talking about these issues. However, I do want to be respectful for the families that have lost their loved ones. I mean, this is, you know, we go through this stuff so often, at least it's presented to us so often, we get desensitized that somebody's dad, mom will never come home. Even the killer probably had a family and, you know, he's never coming home either. And, you know, I don't feel sorry for him at all. I feel sorry that he was in that situation, but I don't feel sorry for him because he made the decision and made the bed that he eventually laid in. However, this is bolstering, or the Democrats would like for them to bolster about this particular incident. Now, you have a black man who did the shooting. Now they can't cry racism, 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 white supremacy is the biggest threat to America on American soil. White supremacy has gone up since Donald Trump. White supremacy is the biggest danger to black people in America. The doctor that he killed was black. I believe when I looked at the pictures of the victims, one of the victims looked like he was in his doctor outfit, looked like he was a medical professional. The other pictures, they may have been medical professionals as well, but they were in kind of dressed down clothes. So it seemed like the person that he killed, one of the people that he killed, was a black man. There would be no T-shirt for that black man. There would be no Black Lives Matter. There would be no marches. There would be nothing. No condolences, except for probably the people that loved him and were part of his family. But worldwide and nationwide, there's not going to be the coverage that you see in any of these other situations, as you will see in this Tulsa shooting. I can almost guarantee you. And so you have a black man. And now which weapon of choice do you ban? Because he came with a handgun and a rifle. And according to police documents, he fired both from the handgun and the rifle. Now, police responded properly. They responded. They were there, equipped, ready to go. The guy ended up killing himself. And I want to go back to the comparison, because I know people are going to make this comparison either in their minds or their souls. They're going to make this comparison that, why did they do this in Uvalde or whatever? Now, we would have been having a different conversation if this man had ballistic gear on and he was trying to shoot everybody he could in the hospital. We may have a lot more casualties. And if he somehow got into a room, which the doors are not reinforced anyway, like the classroom doors, But if he got into a room door at the hospital, and some of them are enforced, don't get me wrong. There are some at hospitals, depending on what particular parts you are in the hospital that are very difficult to go through. They have those magnetic locks at the top, and that even if you had a key, you're not going to get through that magnetic lock, especially as a one-person army. So, but if he locked himself behind a magnetic locking door and he began to shoot as many people as he could, I think we would have had a troubling situation like Uvalde, nowhere near the magnitude, because Tulsa PD was well equipped, and I'm pretty sure they have a county sheriff that can respond, and they could have 50, 60, 70 officers all on the same page showing up to that hospital within 10 minutes, which is incredibly different. So a lot to talk about. We got many things we want to talk about. The Marine Corps getting woke. I was surprised that the Marine Corps did that. I was also surprised that NASCAR went super woke on the LGBTQ. So y'all listen to the Austin Tatum Show. Y'all hold the phone if you want to call in. 844-900-7243. 844-900-7243. Hold the phone.
The Officer Tatum Show. 844-900-7243. That's 844-900-7243.
Ladies and gentlemen, yours truly and MyPillow are offering a buy one, get one extravaganza on multiple MyPillow products. Now's the time to join millions of Americans who have changed the quality of their sleep with MyPillow. Right now, buy one, get one free pricing on MyPillow bed sheets, Giza Elegance MyPillows, six-piece towel sets, and roll and go anywhere MyPillows. Just go to the radio listener specials page at MyPillow.com and use promo code Tatum or call 800-976-8379. Don't miss this incredible opportunity to buy one, get one free on select items. You will also receive Mike's book absolutely free with any purchase. Call 1-800-858-0263. Or go to the Radio Listener Specials page at MyPillow.com. Use promo code Tatum.
Breaking news and what to make of it. The Officer Tatum Show.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I got breaking news. Another shooting in Racine, Wisconsin at a funeral home. Right now, or at least at a funeral site, at a cemetery, maybe not a funeral home, but at a cemetery, as the family of a young man named DeShante Lucas King Sr. was being laid to rest after being killed by police in a police dispute. According to some of the reports, it was involving a high-speed pursuit at some point, and somehow there was a dispute between him and the police. You know, if I was a betting man, I'd bet it involved some guns and other stuff that would have probably resulted in a shooting. And as his family is laying him to rest at the cemetery, there's a gunman that apparently gets out. I don't know if he shows up on foot or gets out of a vehicle, and he begins opening fire on the people there at the funeral site. If you ask me, you know, and I'm not, like I said, I wasn't there. I don't have any of the information. It's coming out now. It's breaking. This happened at 2 p.m. today. I believe 2 p.m. in Wisconsin is central. Yeah, maybe it's central time. No, it can't be central. I don't know. I don't know exactly what time is in Wisconsin, but according to the reports, at 2:26 p.m. Yeah, Central Time is when this occurs. So this is an active situation, and the police are trying to find out what happened. But another shooting. You know, I don't know what gun was used. I don't think they have any reports of what gun was used, according to some of the witnesses at the scene. And we all know witnesses may not be telling the truth, or they may be off a little bit. But according to some of the witnesses at the scene on the reports for what news channel is this? I think ABC News, a couple other news channels, that the witnesses say they heard over 30 to 40 shots being fired I don't even know if there's multiple assailants, but there's multiple people that shot. They were sent to the hospital. The hospital's on lockdown. Sometimes when they lock down hospitals after a shooting occurs is if it was they believe it was gang related. So they're afraid of retaliation. So sometimes they'll lock the hospital down. If there's a proximity issue, meaning there was a shooting in the area, they lock the hospital down. But typically, when they're locking the hospital down in situations like this, it's because they're afraid of gang retaliation. And when they lock the hospital down, I'm not sure how far they go, but in cases that I've been involved in, they'll lock the hospital down. You can't even come to the emergency room. So if there's an emergency situation, you're going to have to go somewhere else. This is very unfortunate, but I think these are not the same. You know, I know that this is considered a mass shooting, right? It's probably not a mass casualty situation as of now. There could be, but this is a mass shooting. When you shoot, I believe, three or more people at one time, that can be recorded as a mass shooting. And this is probably gang-related. Now, I don't know that to be true, but based on my antennas that are going off, that this could be a gang-related issue. The other situations were all different. The 18-year-old, I believe he was 18, at Tops grocery store was a white supremacist who had a manifesto who went to kill black people to make a point, and he was a blatant racist. The young man in Uvalde was a sick, well, they both were sick and deranged, you ask me, but I think more of a mental health. Maybe people bullied him. Maybe he was just crazy. Fantasizing over killing people was his MO. He went into a school, reports that I have, that it was his home room. When he went to Robb Elementary, he went into that classroom and began shooting for purposes that are separate from the purpose and intent of the shooter in Buffalo, New York. And this new shooting, if you ask me, based on my training experience and things that I've been exposed to in my life, I could imagine I lean more towards believing this was a gang-related shooting. Now, if you want to talk about mass shootings in the United States of America, I just told you the stats. If you do, three or more people getting shot at one time, that is considered a mass shooting. I'm telling you, every day, when they say mass shootings, they go, we had 250 mass shootings this year. We didn't have 250 people with AR-15s going into schools killing people. We had probably majority of the mass shootings are occurring in places like Chicago, Illinois, St. Louis, Missouri, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, because this is not too far from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and all these other places. Those are most of those mass shootings. They go and they shoot it up and they hit two or three people in a shootout at a funeral, at a party, at a birthday party. That's considered a mass shooting. Now, regardless of that, none of that even matters. How do we get this stuff under control? Ladies and gentlemen, we are not going to be able to stop every single mass shooting. It's not going to happen. We can curb some of this behavior that's going to take decades to fix. When you talk about the godliness in our society, the fatherlessness in our society, is not going to change overnight. That's going to have to be a culture change within the United States of America to see residual effects to that degree. Now, in between time, what legislative action can we take to curb gun violence? I cannot think of a single law that's not already on the books that will prevent gun deaths and mass shootings, whether it's with a rifle or handguns. I can think of the application of laws that are already on the books, meaning that how do we get illegal guns off of the streets? Because they're already illegal. There's not a new law that we need to create. Guns that are not purchased, serial numbered, whatever the case may be, that's not tracked, that come from Mexico or stolen from people, are already illegal firearms. How about we enforce the laws that are on the books? If you are a convicted felon, you should not be able to get a hold of a handgun in this country or a rifle. So how do they get it? They can't go to a store. They can't put in their serial number their social security number and go through the background check because they'll be flagged as a convicted felon or a person who has a history of domestic violence, depending on where they fall in the spectrum. So how are they getting it? Stolen guns. Where are stolen guns coming from? Well, people are not locking their guns up like they're supposed to. And theft and from gun stores and other places like that and guns that are coming over here from the border. All of those things are measures we can take in account. Do we want to protect these institutions where kids are at? Do you want to protect certain places of worship? You can go down the list. How do you do that? We have people who are armed at the scene making it happen. That's how we do it. It's really not that hard, in my opinion, when it comes to making the first step. We don't have to be perfect, but we can make a few first steps. Gang violence in this country can be curbed with the right resources, with the right accountability, with the right focus. And just imagine this. I probably only have about 30 seconds. But imagine if Black Lives Matter raised hundreds of millions of dollars and not focused on black people who are justifiably killed by police, but focusing on the inner city and the issues within the inner city. We could change this stuff in less than a decade. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to The Officer Tatum Show. I'll be back after the break.
Brandon Tatum, the left ain't seen nothing yet.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Officer Tatum Show. I'm your host, Brandon Tatum. Follow me on social media at The Officer Tatum. Go to my website, theofficertatum.com. We'll be keeping you up to date on the breaking news out of Racine, Wisconsin. Racine Police Department reports that multiple people were shot, multiple shots fired at a funeral site. A young man who had been shot by the police was being laid to rest, and a gunman, maybe multiple gunmen, came up and started opening fire at the funeral procession. We'll keep you up to date. Right now, I have a special guest coming on my show. He is a visiting fellow on higher education reform at the Heritage Foundation. My guest is going to talk to us today and give us some more information about the billions of dollars of forgiveness of student loans that Joe Biden has introduced. And I know nothing about the ramifications of that, but my guest does. Welcome to the show, Adam Kissel. Adam, am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It is my pleasure. So, Adam, Joe Biden, I think this is a pledge. I don't know if it's official, but it's a pledge that he's going to forgive $5.8 billion in student loan debt owed by about 560,000 borrowers who attend Corinthian colleges, one of the nation's biggest for-profit college chain before it collapsed in 2015. Can you give the audience some perspective here? Because when I see these numbers, I say, well, hey, what's wrong, you know, inherently wrong with forgiving student loans for people who have worked hard? But can you explain, is this an issue or is this a positive thing coming from the Biden administration?
Well, the Biden administration knows that it can't forgive student loans except in some really narrow areas. So it's been looking for some ways to forgive student loans in those narrow areas and still say that they're doing something. So if you worked hard and you paid off your student loan, then you look at the people who are getting loan forgiveness and you're saying, well, I guess I'm a sucker because I paid my loan off and here's somebody else who didn't work and they haven't paid and they're going to get $10,000 off or maybe their whole loan forgiven. So it's a real problem for people who are the majority who have been working hard and paying off their loans. So I think what you find is in the case of the Corinthian colleges, these are students who graduated or maybe they didn't 7 years ago or farther ago. And Corinthian colleges went out of business because in some ways it was a bad actor. So those students do need to, those alums do need to have their loans forgiven. But the question for them is, should it be their full loan or should it just be partially some part of their loan? And if you look at Corinthian colleges, some of those programs that students graduated from, students are doing fine. They're doing well. But for other ones, students are not doing well. And that's why Corinthian had to close. So for those students who had kind of a bad degree, they really should be have their full loan forgiven. But for the ones who are doing well and are even paying their loans off because they're doing well, it's unclear that they should be paying off, that the government should be paying off their loan when they can pay it. And they actually got a good enough education. So in the case of Corinthian colleges, the real question is, Should you just do one size fits all and give everybody their money back? Or should you acknowledge that some people actually got a good education and be real about that? So the context is, we have $1.8 trillion of student debt in America. That's about 40 million people. So when we're looking at $500,000 and $6 billion, that's significant, but it's really just fiddling at the edges, and it's not addressing the systemic problems with the idea of student loans in the first place that are funded by the government and then forgiven by the government. So for those of us who did things right, it's a bad deal. And for those who did things wrong, they're being rewarded. And on top of that, it's the taxpayer who didn't go to college, who's now subsidizing the one who did. And that also seems to be a bad deal for Americans.
Yeah, Adam, I think that, you know, this is very, a very interesting concept, because I went to college, I was on full scholarship, but then when I went to get my master's degree, I had to pay that out of my own pocket. And I didn't have a problem with it. I knew going into my master's degree program that I was going to have to pay for that. I knew how much it cost, and I weighed the balance of getting my degree versus the cost. And I said, I'm going to have to pay for this, and I'm okay with it. I did not expect the government to forgive me. I don't deserve forgiveness of a student loan that I decided to get out on my own. The question is that how far are we going to go, and will this become a discriminatory action by this administration? Are we going to see, and this is my question to you, do you think that this is opening up the possibility to see the government forgiving loans for, let's say, black people and not forgiving loans for other people based on a social justice narrative?
That's a realistic danger, and I'm sorry to say that it is. We saw in the COVID era, with there being federal programs that did discriminate on the basis of race, and the government gave a reason for that, and pretty much said, we need the court to decide, but they knew they were going to lose in court. And time after time, they do lose in court when those discriminatory programs have happened. But that doesn't seem to stop this administration from trying again. So there really is a potential risk that there could be race or other areas of discrimination in who gets their loans forgiven. I think the chance of that is low, but it's something that really could happen under this administration. So I like that question. The bigger danger really is the mass student loan cancellation, where you're distributing money from the taxpayer who didn't go to college to the one who did. And just that level of social discrimination, sending money in the wrong direction for votes or for whatever other reason, I think that's the bigger mistake that we're in danger of seeing.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to my guest, Adam Kissel, a visiting fellow on higher education reform at the Heritage Foundation. We're here to discuss the debt forgiveness that Joe Biden has done for the Corinthian colleges. And I was reading in an article, it said the Corinthian College became one of the most prominent examples of bad behavior. One of the things that they said allegedly are allegations of illegal recruiting tactics, shady education programs, and false promises to students about their career prospects and their potential future earnings. Is this a conflict of interest specifically that Joe Biden is forgiving the debt and loans from a university that appears to have been participating in alleged fraudulent behavior, and really they've done these kids wrong in many cases? Is Joe Biden putting himself in danger of a conflict of interest here?
Well, the Biden administration, just like the Obama administration, has a problem with profit. So they've been going after for-profit universities and not holding nonprofits to the same standards. And in many cases, if you look at the outcomes for nonprofit college student graduates, they're just as bad or worse than as the for-profit colleges. A colleague of mine at the Texas Public Policy Foundation has proved that in a number of studies. So the conflict for Biden and earlier for Obama was discriminating against profit. And the challenge for Corinthian colleges, which, you know, no longer exists, is that they did double cross many of their students and give bad information. So those students should be made whole. And the hard question is, should they be made whole by having their whole student debt forgiven, or just the part that really was related to fraudulent or other bad actor kinds of activities? So the problem that we also see related to Corinthian colleges is that since the Obama administration and then now the Biden administration hate profit so much, hate the idea of a for-profit college, they took that one bad actor, Corinthian, and have applied it across the board to all the other for-profit colleges. And that's really unacceptable because for-profit colleges are doing a service for our country and for the students who think that's the best option for them. And meanwhile, nonprofit colleges that might have a 10% graduation rate collecting just as much tuition or more are getting a pass. So what I think is the real problem today with the discrimination against for-profit colleges is holding them to a different standard and not caring about the students who are getting a bad education at the regular nonprofit colleges. So there is a conflict there, but not so much a financial conflict of interest, but real discrimination in the wrong direction.
Well, let me throw Adam Kisser is my guest. Let me throw this ranch and this monkey ranch in the system. In 2013, Vice President, then she wasn't the Vice President, then she was the Attorney General. But Kamala Harris, when she was the Attorney General of the state of California, she sued the chain for in 2013 over what she called an unconscionable scheme designed to rack in profit by targeting vulnerable populations like low-income workers, single parents, and military veterans. So I can't understand why the biggest loan forgiveness program ever is at a university college or a college that's been caught up in schemes, and his vice president actually, as the attorney general, brought a suit against because they were taking advantage of vulnerable people. I only have, how many minutes do I have? I think I got about 30 seconds left. I got 10 seconds left. So, Adam, thank you so much for joining me. I'd love to have you back at another time. Adam Kissel. You guys are listening to The Officer Tatum Show. I'll see you after the break.
Brandon Tatum. The left ain't seen nothing yet. Breaking news and what to make of it. The Officer Tatum Show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Officer Tatum Show. I'm your host, Brandon Tatum. Just in, Joe Biden is limping to the podium to talk to America. And presumably, according to his press secretary, he's going to talk about the gun legislation.
And I visited Arlington National Cemetery. As we entered those hallowed grounds, we saw rows and rows of crosses among the rows of headstones with other emblems of belief, honoring those who paid the ultimate price on battlefields around the world. The day before, we visited Uvalde, Texas. In front of Robb Elementary School, we stood before 21 crosses for 19 third and fourth graders and two teachers. On each cross, a name. And nearby, a photo of each victim that Jill and I reached out to touch. Innocent victims murdered in a classroom that had been turned into a killing field. Standing there in that small town, like so many other communities across America, I couldn't help but think there are too many other schools, too many other everyday places that have become killing fields, battlefields, here in America. We stood at such a place just 12 days before, across from a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, memorializing 10 fellow Americans, a spouse, a parent, a grandparent, a sibling, gone forever. At both places, we spent hours with hundreds of family members who were broken, and whose lives will never be the same. They had one message for all of us. Do something. Just do something. For God's sake, do
Here
something.
Here you go, man.
After Columbine.
He's going to talk. He's going to talk about gun.
After Charleston. He's going to ban some guns. After Orlando. After Las Vegas. After Parkland, nothing has been done. This time, that can't be true. This time, we must actually do something. The issue we face is one of conscience and common sense. For so many of you at home, I want to be very clear. This is not about taking away anyone's guns.
Here you go.
It's about not about vilifying gun owners.
Here
you
go.
In fact, we believe we should be treating responsible gun owners as an example of how every gun owner should behave. I respect the culture and the tradition and the concerns of lawful gun owners. At the same time, the Second Amendment, like all other rights, is not absolute. It was Justice Scalia who wrote, and I quote, like most rights, the right Second Amendment, by the rights granted by the Second Amendment are not unlimited. Not unlimited. It never has been. There have always been limitations on what weapons you can own in America. For example, machine guns have been federally regulated for nearly 90 years, and this is still a free country. This isn't about taking anyone's rights. It's about protecting children. It's about protecting families. It's about protecting whole communities. It's about protecting our freedoms to go to school, to a grocery store, to a church.
It's going to be the biggest gun sales that we've ever seen in America.
According to new data just released by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, guns are the number one killer of children in the United States of America. The number one killer. More than car accidents, more than cancer. Over the last two decades, more school-age children have died from guns than on-duty police officers and active-duty military combined. Think about that. More kids than on-duty cops killed by guns. More kids than soldiers killed by guns. For God's sake, how much more carnage are we willing to accept? How many more innocent American lives must be taken before we say enough, enough? I know that we can't prevent every tragedy, but here's what I believe we have to do. Here's what the overwhelming majority of American people believe we must do. Here's what the families in Buffalo and Uvalde in Texas told us we must do.
Hurry up, old man.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21. Strengthen background checks. Enact safe storage law and red flag laws. Repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability. Address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence.
Ladies and gentlemen, you hear that foolery? Oh, they coming for our guns. They coming for our guns, but they better come and take it because I ain't giving mine up. Listen to the Officer Tatum Show. Catch me after the break.
Brandon Tatum. The left ain't seen nothing yet.
I got a little bit of time left in this segment at the top of the hour. We'll start getting on Joe Biden's head because I need a little more time than what I have now. So I'm going to get a couple callers in. Kristen from San Antonio, Texas. Welcome to the Officer Tatum Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
So the reason for my call, I am very close to Uvalde. I have a friend who actually teaches at the middle school there, and her kids attend Robb Elementary. So this one hit really close to home, and I'm a licensed concealed weapon carrier here in Texas, and I think that there's a large hesitancy amongst the educators in our country in general against weapons, because in order for them to become a teacher, they attend four-year university, where they're continuously inundated with the message and rhetoric that guns are evil. And I think one of the key things to help keep our kids safe is to allow teachers who become educated themselves about firearms to be able to carry those firearms to protect themselves and their students. I think it's incredulous. I was incredulous hearing that our government would not put armed officers in the schools when every single one of them has bodyguards at their doors. It's hypocritical and it's incredibly wrong. Man, I could spend some time unpacking my feelings about Joe Biden's speech that he just gave, because the one thing that he says would cure all of these things is more intervention by schools. And I have to disagree wholeheartedly. The one thing that will stop these school shootings is the intervention of dads in the home. So many of these people who have gone after and done these types of shootings are missing a strong father in their life, not a male role model, not an uncle, not somebody in their school who they're talking to, no, but dads. dads need to be back in kids' lives in a profound way.
Kristen, thank you so much for the call. I agree with you 1,000% as a father, and I have my father in my life, and I wouldn't be where I'm at today if I didn't have a strong father. Agree with you 1,000%. Ladies and gentlemen, when I come back from this break, I'm going to rip Joe Biden a new one. You listen to The Offset Tatum Show. Hold the phone. Welcome back to The Officer Tatum Show. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm your host, Brandon Tatum. You can follow me on all my social media platforms at The Officer Tatum. Go to my website, TheOfficerTatum.com. I have to address what Joe Biden has said. I don't know if you guys have heard it. We picked it up live because that's what we do on this show. We have something breaking. We'll bring it right to you. Joe Biden struggled to stumble out on a podium and tell the American people and challenge them about gun legislation and gun laws, and brought in the stories of those dead children in Uvalde, and he stepped on their backs to push an agenda to make himself a virtuous individual by calling Congress cowards for not doing something with gun legislation. I don't know what kind of crack that Hunter Biden gave to Joe Biden to smoke before he came out and made some of the statements that he made. To say that amendments are not absolute is absolutely out of control. He referenced Justice Scalise and made mention that he had said the amendments are not unlimited or something of that nature. There's a difference between unlimited and absolute. We absolutely have the right that is given to us by God. We have the right to the freedom of speech. We have a right to keep and bear arms, to protect ourselves from a tyrannical government or anybody else. We have a right. Now, there may be limitations and guidance that we can all agree on within that right, but you don't lose your right to freedom. That's not how this works. The people can say, okay, we want restrictions here and there, but you don't have the right to eliminate a person's constitutional right to keep and bear arms, because then you're interfering with the right to pursue freedom and happiness in the United States of America. Now, let me, you know, the pursuit of happiness. Let me go on to other things that Joe Biden had said that I think is tumultuous. When they're talking about banning assault rifles, which is no such thing as an assault rifle. I actually hope they ban assault rifles because there's no gun called an assault rifle. But if they were going to ban AR-15s, it makes no sense. Because I gave this statistic, and I will give it 100 times a day. The overwhelming majority of school shootings, K-12 shootings, are done with handguns. I looked at the numbers. The comparison is about 1,300 incidents happen with a handgun and 107 happen with an AR-15 or a rifle-style gun. That is a disproportionate amount of happenings between handgun and rifle. The majority, overwhelming majority of gun violence in the country is perpetuated by handguns. Then there's knives and sharp objects. And then there's hands and feet. And then there's AR-15s and rifles, or rifle-style AR-15s, or whatever you want to call it. If you look at any statistical data, AR-15s, if you are talking about banning a gun, AR-15s is not the one you want to ban. AR-15s, I mean, the handguns are the ones you want to ban. If you are in the business of banning guns, handguns are the guns that are killing most people, by far. Now, let me get to a couple other points. You look at the school mass shootings. The population age of the most, or the age of the individuals who perpetuate school shootings the most, is 17, followed by 16, and followed by 15. Last time I checked, not one of a 17-year-old, 16-year-old, 15-year-old can buy an AR-15. In some states, maybe they can buy it to hunt, but generally speaking, they can't buy AR-15s. And they dang sure can buy handguns. So put this math together with me. Most of the people who are involved in the school shootings are 17, 16, and 15. None of them are eligible to buy a handgun. Most of the shootings by far are with handguns. So can somebody explain to me why we're talking about rifles when most of the kids can't even afford handguns or using handguns to kill people in schools? It's because raising the age to 21 is not going to change a kid who is a lunatic, who is deranged, who is broken on the inside, and who are struggling with the spirit of evilness. An age restriction is not going to matter. Let me give you an example. Why, Mr. Tatum? Well, you got to be 21 to drink alcohol. You got to be 21 to drink alcohol, to possess alcohol, to have alcohol in your body. You cannot be underage and drink alcohol or possess or buy alcohol. But every day in this country, kids are going to the hospital with alcohol poisoning because on the weekends at the university and colleges, they are getting hammered. How do I know? I went to college before, and I got hammered when I was 18. I didn't have to go to the store because the older guys bought the liquor, and we all got drunk and had a good time. Now, I don't condone getting drunk, and I don't condone violating the law, but let's stop being stupid. Marijuana is federally illegal. Marijuana is illegal in most states in the United States of America. Has that stopped anybody from smoking weed? I got arrested when I was 8 years old for smoking marijuana in a vacant house. It ain't nowhere in the world an eight-year-old should be anywhere near marijuana. But it doesn't matter what the law says. People that want to break the law are going to break the law. And is that an excuse not to do anything? No, I don't think we should not do anything. We don't need to expand background checks. What does that even mean? I'm expanding a background check. In the background check, it already takes you through FBI database. If you are a terrorist, you will fail. If you have domestic violence, you will fail. If you are underage, you can't buy the gun. And if you fill out the form, you have to show identification. If you are a convicted felon, you will fail. What additives are we going to add on to a background check that's going to prevent people who are normal that go crazy after they buy the gun? You know, you're not going to be able to do it with a medical evaluation. Crazy people know how to not sound crazy if they want to carry out a shooting. When they ask you, are you a danger to yourself or others? Do you feel suicidal or homicidal? Somebody that's got their mind made up, they're going to say, oh, no, I feel totally fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with me. Do you have nightmares and dreams? Do you ever dream of think of killing people? No, I do not. I've never thought of that in my life. They're going to skate right through your little additional questioning for background checks. Age doesn't matter. Backgrounds don't matter. Now, how are you going to hold gun manufacturers accountable for an idiot who takes a gun in good faith and turns crazy and kills people with it? How's the gun manufacturer the issue? Now, maybe you can bring some recourse against a person who knowingly and intentionally sells a gun to a person that is a known criminal or a known psychopath. Known. And you have to be knowing and intentional. It can't just be you sold it to a person, you had no idea they were crazy, they go crazy, now you're liable. It's that knowing and intentionally selling guns to people you know are going to commit an act of violence. But gun manufacturers shouldn't be responsible for the actions of people. Just like y'all don't make pharmaceutical companies responsible for vaccines and vaccine injury. Okay, listen. Medical malpractice kills more people in the United States than just about anything you can think of. Medical malpractice kills, and it's a range, but 400,000 people a year at the higher end, and some people believe it's more than that. At the higher end, 400,000 people, the lowest that I've ever seen, and this is them saying that it's extremely low and it's unlikely, but at the lowest I've seen is 200,000 people a year die from medical malpractice. Medical malpractice isn't you accidentally kill somebody acting in good faith. This is malpractice. This means that you are culpable or you're responsible for doing something you shouldn't have done that resulted in the death of another person. And if somebody's listening and you think to the contrary, you can call in. But medical malpractice kills 200,000 to 400,000 people a year. We're not talking about revision or reform in the medical field, are we? Why is that? Oh, because there's a lot of money to be made in pharmaceutical companies. There's a lot of money to be made in hospitals. There's a lot of money to be made with drug dealing, legal drug dealing from the hospital. Every time I go to urgent care, I don't care what I go for, they prescribe me something. I think I had a little fluid in my ear, and I was flying on a plane, and it kind of pushed it around in my ear, and it was hard for me to hear. They prescribed me steroids. ear drop, nose, nasal drop. I'm like, come on, man. And then nasal drop they prescribed to me, I can get over the counter. It's a money-making scheme, ladies and gentlemen. These people are crooked. They are not acting in good faith. If Joe Biden was acting in good faith, he would be honest about gun violence. I didn't hear a single name of children who were murdered in the inner city from that podium. I did not hear a single name. I didn't hear a single reference of young black men, children, murdered in inner cities around our country. Why is that, ladies and gentlemen? Do black lives really matter? Do young black lives matter? I guess it doesn't. If you live in the hood, Democrats don't care about you. They never did. You listen to the Officer Tatum Show. Catch me.
Making a difference in this culture war. The Officer Tatum Show.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to The Officer Tatum Show. I'm your host, Brandon Tatum, and you can follow me on all my social media platforms at The Officer Tatum. I'm so excited to introduce this next guest. He's the vice president of Academy Programs at Prison Fellowship. Let me just say this before I bring my guest in. I have a special place in my heart for Prison Fellowship. I believe that the Prison Fellowship Academy is doing a tremendous work. People have forgotten about the men and women who are in prison, and they need an advocate. They need to come back into the community and do well, and they need people that love and respect them. So my next guest, Cody Wild, welcome to the Officer Tatum Show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm making sure I said your name right, Cody. It's Wild, correct?
It is, yep.
Awesome, awesome. So you're the president of the Academy Programs at Prison Fellowship. I just got a couple questions for you because I'm interested in Prison Fellowship. I talk about it all the time on my show. I mean, you guys are doing such a tremendous work. One of the questions that I have personally, and I'm hoping that the guests will concede this point, is that, you know, is there any prisoner that's not eligible to be a part of the Prison Fellowship Academy if you are, you know, you guys are available at their prison through the warden?
The short answer is no, Brandon. As long as a person has enough time to complete the program, everybody is eligible for it.
Awesome. And what's the success rate? I mean, I saw numbers of millions of people obviously are in prison. Most of them will get out at some point, and most of them will recidivate. So what is the success rate of Prison Fellowship Academy? Once people graduate, how often do they recidivate? Are you seeing that people are re-entering into society in a much better way if they weren't, you know, going through the program versus if they did not?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, our programs have been studied in a number of states by the various departments of corrections. And one of the problems with recidivism is not everybody defines it the same way. But in those states, the Prison Fellowship Academy is amongst the top recidivism reduction programs offered in those departments. What we are also trying to do is to redefine what success looks like. Because a person can get out of prison and not come back, but live under a bridge. You know, we have a much higher bar than that. We want to promote human flourishing, but not only do people cease to commit crimes, but they actually become positive change agents in their communities, whether they're in prison for the rest of their life or they're returning back to their hometowns.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Cody Wild, Vice President of Academy Programs at Prison Fellowship. One of the other questions that I have for you, Cody, is that are these individuals who find themselves in prison for whatever reason, after they go through programs, are you finding that some of them are equipped enough to be mentors, or they begin to teach at the program as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Typically, when we complete the first cohort, we'll retain some graduates to stick around in the living units and mentor the new participants. And then eventually they'll go to other prisons, they'll transfer, And they'll be able to be change agents in those other places. What we really have hedged our bets on, Brandon, is to go deeper with the fewer people, that they can make a much bigger impact for the system, that those who are seen as the center of the problem actually become a part of the center of the solution. And one of our fundamental beliefs is that not only can people in prison change, but we believe that people in prison can change the world if given the right tools and if having mentors walk alongside them in their life transformational journeys.
Prison Fellowship Academy is focused, a Christ-centered approach. Why do you believe that a Christ-centered approach is allowing you guys over at Prison Fellowship Academy to be successful?
Yeah, so our programs are open to people of any faith and no religious preference, but the unique resource that I think we have, you know, coming from a gospel-centered approach is we believe that all people are created in the image of God and therefore have dignity, that are image bearers of God. And secondly, that God creates each person with a purpose. And so those two unshakable convictions allow us to wade into some of the difficult situations and call forth that purpose, walk alongside individuals, train them, and watch them become flourishing and contributing members of their communities.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to Cody Wild, Vice President of Academy Programs at Prison Fellowship. I have a few more questions because, I am personally invested in interest in the Prison Fellowship Academy. One question I have is that I know there could be people who are listening to this right now. I don't know if they have access to the radio in the prisons, but I know that people are listening to this that may have family members who are in prisons. How can family members help get their family members who are on the other side involved in Prison Fellowship Academy? Or even if there were prisoners who have gotten out or people who have family inside and they want to convince a warden, per se, to get this program going to help their family members or other prisoners, how do they go about doing that? As an outsider, how do you go about helping bring this to prisons all across the country?
Sure. So it's really a two-pronged approach. We're trying to launch these all over the place. So we're in right now 171 facilities in 33 states, and we're going to continue that expansion process. And this is again, our cornerstone in-prison program. What I'd encourage family members to do is to reach out to their incarcerated friend or family member and have them connect with their caseworkers or their chaplains on opportunities for the academy. Sometimes it's in the facility already, and they just don't know about it. And so there are applications readily available, typically through the caseworkers or through the chaplains.
Cody, I got one more question for you, and I only have about a minute and a half, maybe less than that. Cody, the 14-day devotional, can you just give us a quick explanation of the 14-day devotional that the prisoners, that listeners or people who support Prison Fellowship Academy can receive? And these are from prisoners, correct?
Absolutely. Yep. So the 14-day devotional is written by incarcerated individuals. And again, this is just a fundamental belief that we don't do things for people in prison. We do things with people in prison. And this is a shining example of that.
Perfect. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to Cody Wild, Vice President of the Academy Program at Prison Fellowship Academy. If you are interested in getting involved in Prison Fellowship Academy, you want to support, you want a 14-day devotional written by a prisoner for Prison Fellowship Academy, all you have to do is go to theofficertatum.com and click on the Breaking the Cycle of Crime banner, and you can participate today. You guys will be blessed. Cody, I have 30 seconds. Do you have anything else you want to add as we go into the break?
Yeah, I just want to encourage everybody that get close in any way you possibly can. Try to learn more about the journeys that people walk while they're that lead them to prison, and to just realize everybody has a story. And one in three Americans have a criminal record, so you probably already know somebody who's done it.
Officer Tatum Show, 844-900-7243. That's 844-900-7243.
That's right, that's right, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. The Wild Thing. How many of y'all know that song? And I'm a young dude, and I know that song, so I know some of y'all know that song listening to me. Anyway, I got a couple people calling in. If you want to call in, dial 844-900-7243, 844-900-7243. Call in. We have Brian from Ohio. Welcome to the Officer Tatum Show.
Officer Tatum, I just want to say thank you for filling in on a spot on a station. Just recently discovered you. I'm a veteran myself, law enforcement since 2001. You speak a lot of truth. God has blessed me in many ways. He blessed me again when I found this radio station and you. I'm stunned. I really am, sir. And you speak a lot of truth, and I appreciate you.
Brian, thank you so much, brother. Thank you for your service. Man, I have never gotten this many great calls in my life. Genuine people being inspired by the things that are said on the radio. And I tell you what, Brian, I pray that God bless you and keep you and keep you safe, keep your family safe. And I really appreciate the great comments. You know, it segues me into God, right? I mean, you know, a lot of what people hear. And the reason why I'm not a very boastful person is because I know that this is God blessing me to have a platform and blessing me to be the person that I am, giving me testimonies to share with other people. It's 100% God doing this. I say 99.999% God doing this, and then a small percentage of me being willing to accept God doing this in my life. But it is a blessing to be able to change people's lives and be effective. Let me give y'all a story. This is a little bit of my backstory. We talk about the media all the time, but people who don't know much about me is that I thought I was going to play in the NFL. When I was in high school, man, I was a U.S. Army All-American, a top player in the nation. I had scholarships everywhere I wanted to go, and I was a great athlete. I ran a 4.3 and a 40. I mean, I was a freak athlete. I could have competed and did better in the NFL combine when I was a freshman. Before I ever played a single down of football in college, I had numbers that were better than NFL players. And I just knew that was going to happen for me. And, you know, when it did not happen because of multiple reasons, you know, I had terrible attitude coming into college. I got into it with the coaches all the time. And it just was a bad environment for me. And I never left. I got saved in 2008. So I believed that God was going to turn it around, which he did, but did not in the way I thought. And, you know, I was devastated, man. You guys listening to me have no idea. I was devastated when I did not make it to the NFL. I really thought that my purpose was over. I thought that I didn't know where to go. I said, God is pretty much done with me. I blew my opportunity. I didn't play in the NFL. I'm not going to become anything but an average Joe, in my opinion, in my mind. And I found policing. I joined the police department. I didn't want to be a cop. I never thought about being a cop. I needed a job. And I did a ride along, fell in love with policing. And I said, you know what? I want to do this. And I finished the application on the police department. I was a police officer for almost 7 years on a SWAT team, PIO, field training officer. I was going to be in the process to become a sergeant. I did everything I could on the police department. I love every minute of it. I miss being a cop. I want to go back to being a cop, to be honest. My wife told me no. But with that, God has really gave me an opportunity to do more. As a servant police officer, God opened up my mind to politics, to policing. I mean, I had no idea what policing was about until I became a police officer. And then when I thought policing was the gift that God gave me, when I thought policing was my calling, the calling on my life indefinitely, I went back to get my master's degree because I wanted to be a police chief. I mean, that was it for me, y'all. And then God got me into politics. I went to a Trump rally just because I was just open to seeing what was going on. I wanted to see if this dude, Trump, was really who they said he was. Was he a racist, or was this dude going to be the next president? I mean, Ben Carson endorsed him, and I loved Ben Carson. And I made a video. I wasn't even trying to make a video. Never made a video a day in my life, man. I just didn't feel like typing. I had worked a night shift. I had been up all night. And I said, let me just make a quick video about my experiences because I'm pretty much blown away at what I saw. And it went viral, man. It went out of control viral. I made videos as a police officer. Colin Kaepernick video, I blew up. I had my SWAT hat on, and I blew up on Colin Kaepernick in my hot car in my garage. And that's a long story about how I even got to that point. And there's a lot of people I owe a lot of credit to that, you know, ended up putting me in a position to make that video. So I made the video. That thing went mega viral, and I left policing. And I met Candace Owens. We started Blexit together, and I've just been traveling the world. I mean, not the world, but I've been traveling the country, speaking at events, talking online. I've been doing this for about 5 years on YouTube. I got almost 2 million subscribers on YouTube. I make two or three videos every single day for the last 2 or 3 years. And I'm just incredibly blessed that God has given me this platform, and God has blessed me the way he has. When I got saved, I had all these great ideas about football. But one thing I learned about being saved and being in the kingdom of God, and those prayers that I set up, snot coming out my nose, crying, praying to God, them nights saying, God, whatever you, however you want to use me, use me. I didn't know that the football thing was not going to be used, but all of those nights ended up in the position that I am in today. I remember watching Larry Elder and thinking Larry Elder was the greatest thing since sliced bread, which I still think he's incredibly amazing. I never thought one day in my life that I would be sitting in the same seat as Larry Elder talking on the radio, syndicated all across the world. Never once thought I thought this would happen to me. Never once. But I'm going to give you guys a nugget of information that I think is invaluable, is that never say no to opportunities. Even if you have fears, you never say no to an opportunity. I'm going to be honest with y'all. I am not a strong reader. This was very intimidating having to do live reads. You know, I'm not the smartest person in the room. You know, I grew up in the inner city in Fort Worth, Texas. I went to public school. You know, I don't think I'm the smartest guy since sliced bread. I have common sense. But when information or when opportunities present themselves, no matter what your fears are, no matter what people tell you, you go for it. You pursue it with all you got, and you let God deal with the rest. When I took over this radio show, I said, I don't know what's going to happen with this radio show. I ain't never done radio a day in my life. Well, I did a little bit of radio here locally for a couple months on a little weekend show I had. But I never really had a significant experience doing radio. But you know what I said? And I got about probably 30 seconds left. Y'all hold the phone. I said, God, if you want me to do this, bless me to be a blessing to other people. Bless me to read these live reads so I can make it through this, you know. And now I don't even have to look at it. A lot of these products I own, relationships I've built with many of these people, and it's been a tremendous blessing, especially Peer Talk. I got my Peer Talk phone right here. But anyway, I love you guys. Y'all hold the phone. Chuck, Brian, Rose, Scott, I'll try to make it to you after the break. Hold the phone.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.